Welcome to another episode of Exposing South Carolina Family Court and Corrupt Politicians. As usual, we have Bridget, our counselor extraordinaire. We have Marty, our parent extraordinaire. And myself is Clint Doran, who is a family rights activist. We talk about shared parenting. We talk about corrupt politicians who make money off of these children. We talk about the hardships parents and children endure when they go to family court. So tonight's three subjects are the requirements that a judge has to look at before deciding custody. Okay? The second subject we're going to talk about is Bridget.
The tender years doctrine.
Yep. And we're also going to be talking about a case that I'm personally aware of and involved in an aspect. The case is called Ashley Kidwell, is his mom in this case. And we're going to be talking about what she's enduring, what she's being forced to do, and what's currently going on. So this is a very current situation for this mom. So let's get started. If you go to the South Carolina Code of Laws, which you can find online, and one thing I'm going to say is, folks, we got to remember, the three of us are not attorneys.
Yes.
This is not legal advice.
No.
We're giving you public information that you yourself can find, and we're discussing our three individual opinions on it and how the system is using this stuff. Mm-hmm. So here are some of the things. If you go to the Code of Laws for South Carolina and you look at section 6315-240, it reads, contents of orders for custody affecting rights and responsibilities of parents, best interests of the child. That is the section we're going to be reading about tonight.
Mm-hmm.
So here is what it says, folks. A, in issuing or modifying an order for custody affecting the rights and responsibilities of the parents, the order may include, but is not limited to, the approval of a parenting plan, the award of sole custody to one parent with appropriate parenting time for the non-custodial parent, the award of joint custody, in which case the order must include residential arrangements with each parent in accordance with the needs of the child, and how consultations and communication between the parent will take place, generally and specifically, with regard to major decisions concerning the child's health, medical and dental education, extracurricular activities, and religious training. Other custody arrangements, as the court may determine to be the best interest of the child. And you're going to hear that term all throughout every episode, is best interest of the child.
Best interest, yeah.
B, in issuing or modifying a custody order, the court must consider the best interest of the child, which may include but is not limited to the temperament and developmental needs of the child, the capacity and the disposition of the parents to understand and meet the needs of the child, the preference of each child, the wishes of the parents as to custody, the past and current interaction and relationship of the child mm-hmm. with each parent, the child's siblings and any other person, including a grandparent, who may significantly affect the best interest of the child, the actions of each parent to encourage the continuing parent-child relationship between the child and the other parent, as is appropriate, including compliance with court orders. The manipulation or coercion behavior of a parent in an effort to involve the child in the parent's dispute. Any effort by one parent to disparage the other parent in front of the child. The ability of each parent to be actively involved in the life of the child. The child's adjustment to his or her home, school, and community environments. The stability of the child's existing and proposed residence, the mental and physical health of the individual involved, except that a disability of a proposed custodial parent or other party and of itself must not be determined of custody unless the proposed custodial arrangement is not in the best interest of the child. The child's cultural and spiritual background, whether the child or sibling of the child has been abused or neglected, whether one parent has perpetrated domestic violence or the child abuse, whether one parent has relocated more than 100 miles from the child's primary residence in the past year, unless the parent relocated for safety reasons, and other factors as the court may consider necessary. Now, those were the two things that courts have to look at when they decide custody and when they modify custody. And anybody who really paid attention to what I read noticed that when ordering custody, there weren't that many requirements. The majority of the requirements were in determining a modification.
Right.
So there were like 17 requirements for modification, but only about 6 for determining custody.
Okay, yeah.
So let's go back up and let's look at number one, and we'll start talking about just the ordering of custody, basically, here.
Okay. Which
is approval of a parenting plan is number one on the list.
Would you repeat the title that was that you just read?
That is title 63-15-240.
Thank you.
And it's approval of a parenting plan.
So how many of us who have talked to parents who deal in this stuff have ever heard of one of their lawyers saying you need to fill out a parenting plan and you guys need to agree on it?
That is maybe I should not.
Never heard of it. Doesn't happen.
I was going to say the same thing. I've never
exactly exactly. The majority of the parents I've ever spoken with in the state of South Carolina, only 2 people, and I've spoken to probably about 8,000 parents in this state. Mm-hmm. Only 2 people have ever mentioned they had to get a parenting plan done.
Huh.
And this is a state requirement.
This is not a visitation plan. This is a parenting plan.
Yes, a parenting plan. Some people are going to ask, what's a parenting plan?
Right.
A parenting plan is basically both parents sitting down and writing down a list of what they're willing to agree to for the child.
And they do this before they have children, right?
No, they do this at the end of the process when they're getting ready to split.
Right. Oh, geez.
So here we have another section of the state statutes for children, and no one's following it.
Right.
No one's even talking about it.
No.
Now, the other catch is with this statute is it's what the judge wants to consider. These are examples. These are not all of the lists that the judge can consider, but it's the majority of them, the ones they feel were important enough to write down in this document and say, this is what needs to be done.
Right.
So the second one is the award of sole custody to one parent with appropriate parenting time for the non-custodial parent.
Too much subjective wording.
Yes,
exactly.
Very vague on the time.
Yes.
It does not read with appropriate every other weekend parenting time for the non-custodial parent.
Right.
It says appropriate parenting time for the parent.
That's completely in the air, up in the air.
Exactly. And what you'll find is if people start looking through these statutes themselves, they will find that every one of them is written either vaguely or it's written in such a manner to where you have to read it 17 times to even make sense of a portion of it.
Can interpret it however you want to, or the lawyer wants.
Correct. Because you have to remember, these are lawyers who write these things.
Right.
So I was granted, in my divorce, I was granted every other weekend, which the judge, and I was a stay-at-home dad, which the judge said that's appropriate parenting time for him. He's a male. He gets every other weekend.
Okay.
As the stay-at-home, my children and I spent 24 hours a day together prior to filing a divorce.
Right.
For 3 years.
Oh.
So that time is cut down to 48 hours.
That's awful.
So is that in the best interest of a child?
No. That's also not appropriate as far as, I don't think most people would see that subjectively as being appropriate time.
But again, These are the judges. These are the ones ordering this. So in their brains, it's saying, yeah, every other weekend is acceptable for these people, for these parents.
And your lawyer was okay with this?
I was pro se in my divorce.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Yeah, the two lawyers I had hired in the beginning, I won't mention their names.
Right.
They didn't want to do what I asked.
I see.
And a lot of people get this from their lawyers. They're saying, hey, I'm the lawyer. I know what needs to happen.
Right.
People forget that they're paying these lawyers. These lawyers work for you in essence. Mm. You tell them what you need and what you want.
Right.
Their job is to get it for you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if they can't get it for you, their job is to come to you and say, hey, they're not willing to budge on this, but they're willing to do this. That's right. Negotiation.
Right.
and some people call it mediation.
Mediation, yeah.
Okay. But again, like I said, best interest of the child is that one parent who's been a mainstay in their life gets every other weekend.
Mm.
And heaven forbid you try to fight for more time, you actually lose time. They actually will take time away from you.
As I mentioned in the last episode.
That you lost, that the person you have lost.
Finish you for fighting.
Yeah. If
correct.
You fight. Yeah.
Because in my case, I filed an appeal and I was put on supervised visitation with a gentleman who works for the Richland County CASA who charges $80 an hour.
That's right. To be a babysitter.
To do this supervised visitation.
Right.
Simply because I was fighting the decision, the judgment.
Goodness. So you're being
now popular. one of the things that they will tell you is that you need a change of circumstance for a judge to change anything.
Mm. Okay.
In my case, it was the fact that I was fighting. I wasn't giving up. I wasn't going to let my children just have one parent and then have a visitor.
Right.
I sought shared parenting.
Right.
I sought 50-50 custody. They need me and my wife.
Right.
That's the reality of it. That's what I was asking for, and the courts didn't like it.
Mm.
So, Bridget, do you have these printed up?
No. I have the – yes, I think I have – you mean the actual law?
Yeah, the actual statute.
I don't
know. I'll read it as we go then.
Okay. I have all of the different 17 things. I don't have the other things. Yeah.
Okay. The award, the third one is the award of joint custody in which case the court order must include residential arrangements with each parent in accordance with the need of each child.
Okay.
Now this is, you're reading 63-15-40, right?
240, correct.
240.
Yeah, 240.
Okay.
Okay. So this says that a judge must consider in joint custodies these items. So what is joint custody in the state of South Carolina?
That can be anything. It can be as long as you're getting – actually, I don't know. I think
standard joint Judge Brown's visitation.
Judge Brown's rules, right?
Judge Brown.
Judge Brown.
Yeah. And basically, it's the same thing as the every other visit, other weekend visit.
As long as you have both parents being involved, then it's considered joint custody.
Exactly. The only difference in the two is that legally, the terms are different, and that both parents have a larger say.
Okay.
Just a moment. There's a really bad beeping noise going on.
Yeah, I'm trying to get rid of it. The kitchen kind of smoked up a little bit.
Oh, okay.
I was fixing hamburgers, and they got it a little well done. That's fine. Dog won't mind.
Are you telling me your studio is so big and fancy you have a kitchen in it?
Oh, I have a kitchen. I have a jacuzzi in my studio. These are the perks of a podcast.
And you have a puppy.
Yeah,
I have a very big puppy.
Yeah,
there is, are it, is it true? Is it true you're in Rush Limbaugh's old studio?
Hey, it was cheap. Nobody else wanted it because they felt Rush Limbaugh's ghost is here.
Presence.
Okay. But back to the okay. completely off track. The thing about it is, again, it's the same thing as sole custody for most judges.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
And we're not going to sit here and we're not going to read all the requirements. We're just going to pick out the ones that are important to people to start educating themselves on.
Okay.
The preference of each child.
Right.
Okay. How many people have ever heard or seen a judge ask the child, where do you want to live?
Right. That's what I read about a lot, was about that the child's preference would be taken into consideration. But, you know, it's never been done in any cases that I've been witness to, except through the guardian ad litem.
Exactly. And here's the thing. The only case law that has ever cited in the state of South Carolina that a judge heard the preference of a child was in 1982, and the child was 12 years old.
Mm-hmm.
The judge wanted to hear what the child's wishes were.
Okay.
So the child got to come onto the stand and state, I would like to live with parent A or parent B.
And so now, why that time? What was so special?
It's up to the judge's discretion.
Huh.
The judge does not have to hear the child. It's up to the judge's discretion. And that's where the guardian item comes in.
Uh-huh.
People.
Let me ask a completely ridiculous question.
Okay.
Why do the judges not go by these statutes, these laws?
Because in many cases, you have to consider these people have been lawyers for 8 years or more. They practice how to avoid getting around these laws. So that's their knowledge base. Their knowledge base isn't the law itself. Their knowledge base is how to avoid these laws.
Right.
So
do you think they've even read these?
And all honestly, they probably read them when they went to law school.
I was about to say, for the bar exam.
Yeah.
It's kind of like me when I took my national board. I don't remember a darn thing about any theories or therapists that were important. But I know how to practice. And lawyers know how to practice. It's just a matter of knowing the law is a little bit more difficult.
Exactly. I mean, I've never heard a lawyer actually quote one of the actual statutes verbatim.
Right.
They've always quoted, well, I think it says this. Yeah. So it tells me right then and there that these people do not know the actual statutes.
Right.
So that does that answer your question?
Yes. That takes care of it. I do believe that they just don't know and they don't care.
Okay, so that's, I mean, this is the thing we're pointing out here, and I think that pretty much what we're trying to show with this section is that the judges aren't going by statute. They're going by what they know as a lawyer. They're going by what they've done as a lawyer, but not as a judge.
Right.
You know,
they don't even go by it as a parent, apparently, if they're a parent. They award one person primary custody. I mean, you would think that as a parent, they would look at it and go, oh, if I got divorced, what would I want for my kids?
Right.
Exactly.
Which is the best interest of the child, act or whatever. They don't call it an act, but that's what they put in place after the tender years.
Exactly.
But
and so here's the thing we're getting at, though, is throughout the whole statute, throughout the whole title, actually, you hear that term, best interest of a child.
Right.
What is the best interest of a child?
Well, I mean,
Overnight visitations with Michael Jackson.
Oh, gosh.
Golden.
Too soon. Too soon.
Jesus juice.
Jesus juice. What is that?
Well, here's the problem with that. The best interest of a child is dependent on every situation.
It's
every
exactly.
Case.
There is no one, you know, pat answer. Absolutely.
Exactly. There isn't. So this is also where the judicial discretion comes in that the family court judges have.
Right.
They have judicial discretion to make their rulings ignoring the law, but in their opinion.
Right.
You know, these are statutes, and we all know what statutes are. They're the laws of the state. This is what's supposed to happen, because that's the way it is in the criminal courts.
Right.
Family courts, these statutes are considered guidelines by judges. They're going like, okay, well, this is what it says, but I don't have to follow it. It's a guideline. You know, I got leeway here. I have judicial discretion.
Right.
You mean like the speed limit is just a suggestion?
I agree with that one. I do agree with that one. It is just it's just a suggestion.
The car came with turn signals, and it's brand new.
Right.
It's a suggestion. You use them.
Exactly. So, again, you know, not all judges do this. Some judges do try to stay with the statutes. But in reality, the majority of them ignored and just go by what the lawyers, the actors in these cases, tell them.
Well, and I was going to also bring up the fact that I work with a lot of guardian ad litems. And some of them are amazing, absolutely amazing at their jobs. And they really do want to get, like we're talking about, they work in the best interest of the child. And then there are some who are human, and we all are, and flawed individuals, but they seem to either always have a bias towards a father, or always towards the fathers, or always have a bias towards the mothers. It just seems to be that they, in case after case after case, we see them, oh, well, if it's this one, we know they're going to go for the father. If it's this one, they're always going to go towards mom. And it's like they go in with their minds made up, and the reports are going to reflect that. But I was doing some research as to, you know, how much the guardian ad litem, I'm sorry about my voice. I'm sorry. It's just like horrible. How much their opinion actually affects the judge's decision. And it actually does not affect it. It's called a recommendation, actually, is what
exactly
they are not. It's basically something that they get paid very well to do, very, very well to do. But it is not something that is the case will rest on. The judge's decision is not going to rest necessarily on a guardian ad litem's decision. So I just wanted to throw that out on that.
Exactly. I mean, you're completely right. And it's important also to put out there that there are two types of guardians. Mm-hmm. There is a lay guardian, which are the people in your neighborhood. Your neighbor could be a lay guardian, a volunteer who actually wants to help children.
Right.
Then you have attorney guardian ad litem's.
Right.
These are attorneys who practice in family law or want to make a little bit of side money from whatever practice they do,
right.
Okay? And these are the ones that are getting paid the moochu dollars to do nothing, basically.
Right.
Okay? So the other thing is guardian ad litems are called voices of the children. They're there to be the voice of the child. That is not correct. Now, we're going to do an episode dedicated completely to guardian ad litem. We're going to have Nathan Ginner on, who was a former guardian ad litem. And he's going to give us a ton of information pertaining to the training they receive, the requirements, what they have to do, how much they get paid, all this stuff. But he hit it right on the nail with everything you said. And the other aspect of this is guardian ad litems actually work for the court. They're the court's eyes.
Right, right.
They are required to do an independent investigation.
Right.
to determine what might be in the best interest of a child.
Right. But it is an investigation, okay. Yes. And it should that's what they call it. Kind of like, it's kind of like a DSS, you know, ruling.
Well, that's what they call it, is they call it an investigation. Mm-hmm. Some lay guardians actually do their homework.
Right.
Where others don't.
Now, I do know the attorney ones don't.
We mentioned in an earlier episode that attorney guardians aren't required to do anything except look at paperwork if they want. Mm-hmm. They don't have to speak to a child. They don't have to go out and visit at the home. They don't have to observe the child with each parent.
Right.
Because the court looks at it that they're a family court lawyer, or they're a lawyer. They know what to do and what's good by looking at paperwork. Mm-hmm. But they can charge their hourly rate for this as a guardian. So when we talk about cases that are $30,000 guardian ad litem fees, those are usually attorney guardians.
Oh, yeah. No.
Where lay guardians don't earn as much in any capacity.
No.
But we're going to get that into that with Nathan Ginter when he comes on the show. So again, best interest of a child is variable depending on the case itself, depending on the child, the parents, sure. the situation.
Sure.
You know, the best interest of a child of domestic violence is not going to be the same as a child who's in a normal, non-commercial divorce.
Right.
Okay. But the basics are the same. Mm-hmm. A child needs both parents as long as there's no abuse or neglect.
Mm-hmm.
A child needs the love from both parents. This nurtures them emotionally, mentally. There are things the father's going to be able to do with them that the mom can't. And there are going to be things the mom can do that the dad can't.
Of course.
Okay?
Of course.
So that's the basics we have with preferences and child custody thing. They're not, judges aren't going by the statutes. And the other kicker to this is they literally have to write in their orders why they made these decisions.
The basis for the decision, yeah.
They have to literally state that parent A deserves custody because parent B is a bad cook.
Oh. Oh, my. I'm glad I never read that.
Mm. Exactly. In there, well, it's, you know, we're giving an example. That's
no, I know.
Close to my God. But
I know of a case.
Yeah, there you go.
I know of a case where the attorney guardian ad litem said, I'm going with the mother because the child knows too much about the divorce case. And exactly. The father had never mentioned the divorce to the child.
The father had what?
Never mentioned the divorce to the child.
So, what was... So the mother had obviously...
Yes, the mother had done all the talking.
And that's even one of the... That's one of the things that it was talking about as far mm-hmm. as the modifiers or the whatever modifications as far as whether the...
Whether yeah. one parent is disparaging or discussing the case in front of the child.
Yes, exactly. So that was against, that's absolutely the opposite of what the...
Even in my case, mm-hmm. even in my case, my ex-wife was telling our oldest son what was going on in the trial. No. In this segment, we're going to be talking about a document that has been all over the U.S., that has been abolished in all over the U.S., it's called the Tender Years Doctrine. This is the doctrine that most states use to determine custody. If a child was below a certain age, the mother automatically got custody based on gender. So, Thomas, go ahead and tell us what that doctrine read.
According to Wikipedia, historically, English family law gave custody to the children to the father after a divorce. Until the 19th century, the women had few individual rights and obligations, most being derived through their fathers or husbands. In the early 19th century, Caroline Norton, a prominent social reformer, author, journalist, and society beauty, began to campaign for the right of women to have custody of their children. Norton, who had undergone a divorce and been deprived of her children, worked with politicians and eventually was able to convince the British Parliament to enact legislation to protect mothers' rights for the Custody of Infants Act 1839, which gave some discretion to the judge in a child custody case and established a presumption of maternal custody for children under the age of 7 years, maintaining the responsibility from financial support to their husband. In 1873, the Parliament extended the presumption of maternal custody until a child reached 16. The doctrine spread in many states of the world because of the British Empire. By the end of the 20th century, the doctrine was established in most of the United States and Europe. Now, and this is short, in the United States, the tender years doctrine was also frequently used in the 20th century, being gradually replaced towards the end of the century in the legislation of most states by the best interest of the child, quote unquote, doctrine of custody. Furthermore, several courts have held that the tender years doctrine violates the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. However, this doctrine is still used in many cases, which has prompted family court reform similar to criminal justice reform.
Okay, and that was spot on. Now, I'm going to tell Thomas, does it state when this was written?
It does not.
Okay. I can tell you now, because of the research I did, is the tender years doctrine in most states have been completely abolished around it started disappearing in 2002, and by 2014, South Carolina was one of the last states that had it, and they abolished it. So the tender years doctrine officially does not exist in most states anymore. Here's a problem that exists in family courts when it comes to the tender years doctrine. Is most states did this. They said, okay, it violates the 14th Amendment. We got to get rid of it. We're going to sign a paper and say it no longer exists. But what they didn't do is they didn't go back in and change the laws that the tender years doctrine modified. So the mentality and the basics of the tender years doctrine are still in legislation.
Right.
If you go through South Carolina's laws, they use the term mother, wife. You don't see the word father or husband used as much.
Huh.
And one of the things you read, so Marty, this is again what something you read, is this is also the creation of child support.
Yes.
This is the reason child support was created, because even back then, fathers were considered the breadwinners.
Right.
They're the ones making the money. They're going to the mines, to the coal fields, the cotton fields, wherever they were working, bringing home the money to take care of the wife and the child. So when a wife was able to get her rights, you know, when a woman was able to get their rights through the suffrage movements and stuff, they said, well, we need the money. You know, we need the kid and the money. So that's how all this developed. And so if you ever
– I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Tracy. Go ahead, Bridget.
I'm just wondering how the men, before the tender years doctrine was put in place, how were the men going out and earning the money? And also, because I couldn't find any of that in my research, and also taking care of these children, were they just having a lot of nannies? Or, I mean, is that just a...
Basically what happened in those early days is there were most families moved together. You would move if your parents moved. So the children always had a grandparent or an aunt or something like that to take care of.
Okay.
It's a funny thing you brought that up. There's a movie that came out in the 90s, I believe, with Pierce Brosnan. And it's based on an actual story of an Irish father who lost custody of his kids after his wife passed away to the state of Ireland.
Oh.
And he fought the state of Ireland to regain custody of his kids.
Mm-hmm.
Very good movie. I mean, when I first watched it, it was before I was married, and it brought tears to my eyes because just the in-depthness of the story itself.
Right.
So if you want to look it up, you know, look up Pierce Brosnan, look at his film biography, you'll see it in there. But that is the basics of tender years doctrine.
That's
We don't have it, but its ghost is still there in legislation.
Right, right. Mm-hmm.
So one of the things legislators need to do is they need to go back and they need to change and modify the laws that were affected by this document.
All right.
And bring them up to date. I mean, we've said it before. Most of South Carolina's family laws are still from 1976.
Mm.
Yes, if you look them up, you'll see modified in 2008, modified in 2012. That's wording that was modified.
Right.
Not the meaning of the laws.
Right. And not the judge's mindset.
Exactly. You know, the judge's mentality is still based on the Tender Years Doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
Because it didn't – here's the basics of family law. It's never developed with society. If you look at today's statistics, more women have gone out to the workforce.
Right.
Women are earning equal pay or even more so than a male figure at this point in certain areas of work.
Certain fields. Yeah.
So this allows a lot more fathers to stay home and become stay-at-home dads.
Right.
Okay. So even if a dad who is staying home has a part-time job, he's still not protected under the laws of most states. He's still considered as he just doesn't want to work.
Mm.
You know, so the ghost is still there of the Tender Years Doctrine.
Right.
It needs to be done away with, in my opinion, is a lot of people need to write their legislators, their House representatives, their senators, their congressmen, whatever.
Right.
And have these people to go back and say, we need updated laws for our family courts, our domestic relation courts. You know?
Right.
We're using ancient laws for modern families.
Right. And tell me if this is still the case, because this was the last, the research that I did saw, was that the father, and I think this is still the case, father has to prove a mother unfit, whereas... Correct. In order to get custody, whereas a mother does not have to prove a father.
Correct.
Okay.
That is still the way it is in domestic relations courts.
So it's completely, completely unfair. And
it's exactly. It's still the gender bias that happens.
Mm. Yes. Can we also explain just what the 14th Amendment?
Yeah, I didn't know what the 14th Amendment
is. In layman's terms, because it is not in layman's terms.
Okay, basically the 14th Amendment protects you, your civil liberties.
Okay.
You know, you can't be sentenced to jail for certain things. Exactly. You know, just civil rights, basically.
Okay.
Your pursuit of happiness.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And believe it or not, there are Supreme Court family court cases that have gone to Supreme Court. It's one of the large arguments in these cases that they're – judgments in family court somehow violated their 14th amendments.
Hmm.
And they're valid in a lot of cases.
Liberty and property.
Oh.
Because children, we can't forget this, children are property in domestic relations courts.
That's right.
So, judges need to educate themselves. You know, we can't say that it's all up to the legislators, but judges who sit on these high positions, who have this power, need to educate themselves.
Right.
And they don't.
Right.
There are a handful of judges in this state.
We're also presuming that many of them, we don't want to be, you know, painting it across the board, that many of them do know these things but don't care. Is that possibly true?
That's possibly true as well. I'm sure it's more true than not. But we can't say that without certainty.
Right.
You know, again, you're going to have good people and bad people in no matter where you go.
Right.
So we can't generalize these judges or these lawyers. You have to take them by an individual aspect. Right. In my 8 years of fighting in family court, I've had some very good judges.
Absolutely.
But I've had more bad judges.
Yeah. Wow.
I've come across good lawyers, but more bad lawyers. So, and again, I mean, what determines a bad judge or a bad lawyer? Well, they ruled in my favor. That makes him a good judge.
Right. That can't.
On the case for me, that makes her a good lawyer.
Right.
You know, it's all personally subjective. And that's one of the problems, that there is no standard set for these judges or attorneys.
Right.
They're not accountable for a lot of things because of the judicial immunity they have.
Right.
So, yeah, and
good luck suing an attorney. Good luck. Have you ever heard of anybody winning a
Who would take the
case? Actually, I have. Marty, you actually, have? I have. Yeah, and we're going to get into that. That's another subject we're going to bring Nathan Ginter into.
Oh.
Hopefully, I guess. And we're going to get into that subject.